Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. Safe to say, the testimony of former FBI Director James Comey last week was an extraordinary event which had Americans glued to their TVs and other electronic devices. At the same time, there was a lot happening elsewhere in Congress, and this is what we're talking about this hour. The very latest on efforts to roll back Dodd-Frank banking regulations, plans to cut personal and corporate tax rates, and the movement among a group of Republican senators to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. We start with health insurance. Jennifer Habercorn is healthcare reporter for Politico. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. Let me first give the number out for the comment line. It is 267-405-2006, and that number is good for calling or texting. So, Jennifer, while the nation was glued to the Comey testimony, Senate Republicans, about a dozen of them, and of course, all male, as many of us know, were acting quickly to move their version of the American Health Care Act along, the replacement for Obamacare. Do we have a sense of what they've come up with so far and whether it dovetails significantly with legislation that the House passed in May?
They have not released any bill yet. They claim that it's not finished yet and that there's still some outstanding issues to be discussed. And they also say that their bill is going to be different than the House. But from my conversations with several Republican lawmakers, I think the bill is going to be somewhat similar to the House, perhaps a little more moderate than the House, just a couple things tweaked. But Republicans are still grappling with some significant issues. There's a big debate in the Senate on when to repeal the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. And they're still not at 50 votes. There's 52 Republican senators. Right now, there are three that have raised significant issues. And Mitch McConnell can only afford to lose two votes if he's going to get this through the Senate.
Well, let's talk about the working group and the decision to roll back the expansion of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. What is the reason that the Senate might not want to go as far as the House wants to go with the ACHA?
There's about 20 Republican senators who are from states that expanded Medicaid. It's kind of a surprising number because most red states did not expand the program under the Affordable Care Act. But those about 20 Republican senators are very worried about having to go tell their governor that they're about to lose a ton of federal money, because then those governors would have to decide whether to cut people off the Medicaid rolls in their state or try to come up with that money elsewhere in their budget. And of course, most states cannot afford to make that kind of a decision. So those Republican governors are pushing Mitch McConnell to not roll back the Medicaid expansion right away. They want about 5 to 7 years to roll that back. Of course, you can argue that in 5 to 7 years, a lot of those governors will no longer be in office. They would be term limited out. And kicks the can down the road, which is, you know, Washington's favorite strategy when they don't know what to do about something. So they're making this case right now, but they're up against other Republicans who feel like Medicaid has gotten out of control, and they see this as their opportunity to really tighten up the program.
Another difference between House and Senate in overhauling the Affordable Care Act, the House bill would grant waivers to allow states to opt out of safeguards, which ensure that insurance companies charge everyone the same rates, regardless of pre-existing condition. The Senate will likely not go this route. What do Republican leaders in the Senate prefer, at least at this point, Jennifer, or seem to prefer?
They really saw that the House got a lot of political blowback for that provision. I mean, the pre-existing conditions protections in the Affordable Care Act are one of the most popular and well-known provisions. And we saw that the House just got a lot of blowback for allowing states to have that option. There are a couple of Republican senators who want to do the same thing as the House, but the vast majority of them do not want to touch that provision. They want to leave that as it is in the Affordable Care Act. And as of right now, it seems like that's the route that the Senate's going to go.
The GOP wants to repeal Obamacare taxes, and in fact, the House bill would roll back most of them. But Senate Republicans are finding this might not be doable. Do you have any more information on that?
Yeah, this is another area that they are sharply divided. Every Republican, in theory, wants to get rid of the taxes in the Affordable Care Act. But what they're finding now is that they need to pay for their bill. And if they keep the taxes around a little bit longer, let's say 1, 2, 3 years, they can do more to try to bring down premiums. They can give insurers significant financial help and pay for it by keeping some of the taxes around. Of course, the conservatives don't like this. They want to get rid of the taxes immediately. And in fact, Senator Rand Paul, perhaps one of the sharpest opponents of the Senate bill, told me that, you know, this is just keeping 90% of Obamacare, including the taxes. And he's been one of the most vocal saying that he can't support this bill so far.
Yeah, and speaking of insurers, Jennifer, you know, those currently in the Obamacare markets, they've got a deadline, as I understand it, coming up in just over a week. They have to decide whether they're staying in the exchanges for next year. Some have already decided to leave. There's obviously a lot of uncertainty about all this. So, you know, and keeping in mind that new health insurance legislation most certainly won't be in place by June 21st, you know, what happens next if insurers continue to leave and there are potentially, you know, no options for some people who are now insured under the Affordable Care Act? Do we know?
Yeah, insurers are trying to draw up a roadmap or trying to, you know, go on a journey when they don't have a map in front of them. They don't know what the insurance market's going to look like next year. Is the Affordable Care Act going to be in place? Is this new bill going to be in place? They just don't know. So what they're doing is they're, you know, calculating that into their premiums. Their premiums are higher than they would be if they didn't have this uncertainty. And I think, you know, we've seen several insurers announced that they're going to leave markets. Just today, one insurer has kind of bucked that trend, saying that they're going to add into some markets. But everything means that premiums go up. I mean, insurers like certainty, and this is the opposite of certainty right now. This is a lot of things up in the air. And so consumers are the ones who see it in their pocketbook when those premiums are higher than they have been in the past. And, you know, over the last several years, premiums have gone up quite a bit in some places. So that's just compounding the bills that a lot of folks are facing.
We are talking to Jennifer Habercorn, who is healthcare reporter for Politico, and taking a look at where we are with the American Health Care Act, which has passed the House and is currently moving through the Senate. Republican senators, Jennifer, are grappling with anti-abortion language, which is a major sticking point for anti-abortion groups who say they will not support legislation if abortion restrictions are not included. So, you know, we can get into the weeds with this a bit with the language, but the House is going with language that's in accord with the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits taxpayer funding for abortion. What is the issue in the Senate? Why don't they simply follow the lead of the House if they are so inclined?
Yeah, because the Senate's controlled by Republicans, you would think they would just do that. And in fact, that's what Republicans want to do. But they're running into some roadblocks. There's the Senate rule. Republicans are using a fast-track procedure through the Senate so that Democrats can't filibuster them. But this procedure, called reconciliation, has a ton of rules attached to it. And basically, the rule is that everything in there has to be related to the budget. And abortion is one of the most common issues that Republicans try to insert into this process, but it isn't related to the budget. And no one has determined yet if this abortion language would meet the rule. Republicans would essentially take the tax credits that people get in Obamacare now to help them buy insurance and add an abortion restriction to them, saying that you can't use this payment to buy an insurance policy that covers abortion. And the Senate parliamentarian, who is a nonpartisan staffer, has to decide, does this abortion restriction comply with Senate rules? Everyone's kind of waiting and with bated breath to see what the parliamentarian decides. And if they can't insert this abortion language, they're probably just going to have to keep what's in the Affordable Care Act, which says that you can use a subsidy to buy an insurance policy that covers abortion. Obviously, this is very controversial because Republicans, you know, have a lot of opposition to using something like an insurance subsidy that's funded by taxpayers to cover abortion. But this might just be a Senate rule issue that they can't get around. What I'm going to be watching for is that if the parliamentarian does rule that they can't insert this abortion language, Republicans might try to kind of work around the parliamentarian. It would be pretty controversial, and I can't see Republicans following through with it, but I think there's going to be some pressure on Republicans to try to work around the rules.
So in the meantime, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has invoked Senate Rule 14, which does what, Jennifer?
That's basically just they fast-tracked the bill to the Senate floor. Normally, a bill would go through committees. In this instance, it would be the Finance Committee and the Health Care Committee, and then it would go to the Senate floor. He went around the committees and just sent it straight to the Senate floor. There has been a lot of opposition from Democrats.
I was going to say, I'm sure they've been vocal about this.
Oh, yes. Consumer groups, Democrats, they're saying, you know, this should go through the committee process. There should be hearings. There should be markups. This should be like any other piece of legislation in that way. Republicans argue that, you know, there's been plenty of sunlight on this process because, you know, we're talking about it on the radio right now. And there's been conversations elsewhere. I will say, you know, Republicans, this working group that you mentioned, the 13-member all-men group, has been meeting for several weeks. Republicans talk about the issue at every lunch that they have, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays in the Capitol. But, you know, we as reporters are not allowed in those rooms. Of course, we try to talk to senators afterward, but they have been pretty tight-lipped. I mean, we know the basic outlines of what this bill will say, but we don't have legislative text. We are not allowed in those meeting rooms. So it has not been a transparent process by any means.
And does this tell you perhaps that we're far from actually having a bill that would perhaps get to the floor for a vote before, I think it's July 4th, what Senate Majority Leader McConnell is shooting for?
Yeah, that's what he would like to do. But that is, you know, inching closer. That's about 3 weeks from now. And Congress does not move fast on anything, let alone something this huge and this high profile. The last couple of days, I feel like a lot of Republicans have kind of hinted that that deadline might slip. The real deadline would really be the August recess when lawmakers leave town for about a month. But, you know, there's some Republicans who argue that the sooner they do this, the sooner they can move on to other things. And we don't know yet which one of those strategies is going to rule the day.
And Jennifer, what's the latest from the White House on all this?
You know, it's been interesting. Donald Trump and the White House were very involved in the House passage of their bill. They've been pretty hands-off in the Senate. I think Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sent a message pretty quickly that, you know, the Senate is not like the House. Senators like to work their will. They like to have their voice heard, where the House might be a little more receptive to the president calling them up and asking for a favor or, you know, asking for their vote on something. So I think we'll see Donald Trump step up those efforts now that a bill is presumably getting closer to the floor. The president is in Wisconsin today, and he's going to be talking with what he calls Obamacare victims. So I think we'll see the president more and more involved in the Senate process in weeks to come.
All right, Jennifer Habercorn, healthcare reporter for Politico. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to talk with you.
We'll talk next about what Republicans are considering in order to pay for the big tax cuts in their budget plan. Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg News will be along. Stay with us for more of Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. President Trump has long promised a plan to cut both personal and corporate tax rates. Republicans in the House and Senate want to roll back taxes as well. The challenge has been getting everyone on the same page without blowing up the budget deficit. Conservative and moderate Republicans in Congress see the way forward very differently. And the Trump administration has so far released a fairly simple outline of its plan, with more promised as the summer goes on. Joining us now to bring us up to speed is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Welcome to Radio Time, Sahil.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with what's happening in Congress. Paraphrasing what you wrote on Friday, leaders are sticking to their calls for revenue-neutral legislation. Quick refresher, what is this exactly?
Well, the idea is that a tax reform, a tax overhaul, would end up changing the tax code in a way that reduces a bunch of taxes, specifically tax rates for individuals and corporations, while increasing other taxes by way of eliminating exemptions and deductions and credits and so forth, these loopholes in the code that benefit specific people. So they want to simplify it, and they want to reduce rates while they do it. That is a stance that leaders like Speaker Ryan in the House and Senator McConnell in the Senate have taken. But increasingly, rank-and-file Republicans are breaking away. They're less and less wedded to it, and the lack of clarity from the White House on this position is only fueling that dynamic. Mm.
Tell us a bit about the border adjusted tax, also known as BAT, and that is among what House Speaker Ryan is supporting. What is this, Sahil, and what sort of support is there for BAT?
Right. A huge point of contention. This is a controversial, far-reaching proposal that Speaker Ryan and his allies in the House released last June. It is the basis for, it's a huge component of their tax reform proposal, I should say that. It essentially replaces the existing corporate tax rate of 35% with a 20% tax that applies to domestic sales and imports and exempt exports. So the idea is to incentivize productivity in the United States and give American manufacturers an edge over foreign competitors. It's expected to raise about $1 trillion over 10 years, which is a huge pay for, a huge offset for the corporate tax rate cut that they want to achieve.
Sounds like something that the White House would support. Is there support for Mr. Trump on this?
There were inklings of some support from the White House early on, but increasingly the White House does not seem to be on board. They're leaning against it, according to top White House officials we're speaking to. And there's virtually no support for this in the Senate. Republicans are not at all enthusiastic about it. There's plenty of opposition, and it's sort of teetering in the House as well. So I think the momentum has moved pretty significantly away from the border adjustment tax.
So, Sahil Kapoor, the goal here in reducing personal and corporate taxes is not to add to the deficit, which stands where?
Well, the national debt is about $21 trillion. The deficit right now is somewhere between, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, to be honest, but it's in the neighborhood of about $600 to $700 billion and rising over time. It's projected to rise on autopilot if things don't change. The idea being that Republicans prefer to tackle that with spending cuts on the tax end. Leaders, at the very least, want to keep the revenue target where it is and just kind of change the tax code in ways that they think would benefit, would have more economic benefit.
Yeah. Well, and again, some touchy areas of the budget are being eyed by conservatives for spending cuts. Welfare is one. The charge here led by Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, no relation. Do you know offhand how much he proposes being cut from welfare?
$400 billion in welfare cuts, and this is a mandatory slice of the budget, which includes it includes popular things like unemployment benefits and food stamps and veterans benefits. This is the slice of the budget that's projected to rise autopilot, and this is where some very conservative members like Mr. Jordan want to cut significantly going forward, and Jordan has suggested using spending cuts as a pay-for rather than raising tax revenues from elsewhere. So this is part of the debate that Republicans are having. And again, the split seems to be enhancing over time, given in part the lack of clarity from the White House and the fact that there's no agreement on what sorts of revenue raisers they would use to make up for the lost revenues on tax cuts.
Yeah. Well, safe to say, I'm assuming that there are a number of opponents to Mr. Jordan's proposal who say this would devastate the program. Is that what you're
right,
hearing?
They're absolutely. That's absolutely correct. Democrats in particular would raise hell about this. These provisions in this slice of the budget would be the argument is that cutting food stamps, cutting unemployment benefits would be devastating to the people who need assistance the most. And that's one of the reasons that this slice of the budget has not been cut. And that's why it would be a heavy lift.
Yeah. And how about entitlements, Sahil, like Medicare and Social Security? Hands off so far?
Hands off and hands off for the foreseeable future. President Trump, we should remember, promised in his campaign repeatedly not to touch Social Security and Medicare. That is going to be a hard one to walk back from. These are two of the most cherished programs in the United States, and it would be hard for anybody to cut them, especially after a campaign when you run promising not to.
Yeah. All right. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is backing the call for revenue neutral legislation. The BAT concept, where is he with this? Do you know?
He told Bloomberg TV in an interview a couple of weeks ago that it's not likely to pass the Senate. I think he was taking more of an observer's position and saying simply that there's not support for it. He hasn't personally taken an up or down view on what he thinks about it, but his job is more to build consensus and see where the numbers are. than necessarily to put his thumb on the scale on something like this. So I think the indications from him are pretty clear that it's not going to happen in the Senate, which means it's dead overall.
So let's look at the numbers. If Republicans in the Senate are going to be successful with tax reform legislation overall, they need to garner 60 votes. There are 52 Republican votes. So first, Sahil, remind us why the need for 60 here.
Well, so interestingly, on tax reform, they may not need 60. They're doing this under a process known as reconciliation, where you can bypass the filibuster. One of the rules of that reconciliation process is that you may not add to the deficit after the 10-year window. That's one of the reasons that revenue neutrality ends up being a procedural a prerequisite rather than just a political or substantive ideal that they want. So I think that's where Republicans can do this with simply 50 votes in the Senate. But that imposes some constraints on them in terms of how much they can cut and what they can do about those.
Well, why would it pose constraints?
Well, the big constraint is what's known as the Byrd rule. You cannot add to the deficit after the 10-year window. So if you do add to the deficit, then what you end up doing is automatically sunsetting those tax cuts after about a decade. It's what happened with the Bush tax cuts, recall, in 2001. They automatically expired in 2010 because they added to the deficit. There were no revenue raisers or offsets to prevent that from happening. And we had a different president, Barack Obama, at the time, who insisted that at least some of those tax cuts expire, the ones that benefited the wealthiest Americans.
All right. Let's talk about the Democratic side of all this, as this is being considered revenue-neutral legislation. Is there any Democratic support for any piece of this at all, and might there eventually be?
The short answer is no and no. let me give you the gist of what of their opposition. I spoke to Senator Ron Wyden, who's the top Democrat on the Tax Writing Finance Committee, and he said there were two prerequisites for him and for his Democratic colleagues in order to get them to even consider this. One is to eliminate any tax breaks that, for the wealthiest Americans. That is a red line for Democrats that they will not cross. The proposals that President Trump has put out, as vague as they may be, and the somewhat more detailed ones that Speaker Ryan has put out, do include massive tax breaks that benefit the highest income Americans. That is not something Democrats will do. The second thing they want to do is for Republicans to ditch the reconciliation route. In other words, don't do this via the fast track measure where you can do this with 50 votes. Do this in a, you know, to try this in a bipartisan way where they can try to get Democrats and reach 60 votes in the Senate. Those are the two things Democrats want. Republicans have shown no signs of budging on both of them, which is why bipartisan support for tax overhaul is extremely unlikely.
Hmm. Have you had a chance, I don't know if you have this information at your fingertips, to gauge public support or lack thereof? You know, obviously, the public's been very vocal when it comes to overhauling the Affordable Care Act. But what about personal and corporate taxes and whether, you know, programs such as welfare should be, you know, cut to pay for this? What are you hearing,
Sahil? That's a great question. So there have been polls about this, and the polls consistently show that tax breaks that the highest earners are very unpopular. Now, that's true on the individual side. That's also true, interestingly enough, on the corporate side. There's actually quite a lot of agreement, bipartisan agreement, that the current corporate tax rate of 35%, the statutory rate, at least, if not the effective one, is too high. Even President Obama wanted to bring that down. The Republicans want to bring that down further. That does not poll well either to the average American. I think that just sounds like a giveaway to wealthy, you know, to wealthy corporate executives. Hmm. So the politics of this are difficult. The politics of tax breaks that benefit certain segments of the population that have been doing very well, while most of the country, or at least, you know, the middle class and the lower middle class struggle. That's a tough political pill to swallow, which is one of the reasons this is so difficult. Even if you can make substantive arguments that it would be good for the economy, it's not easy politically.
All right. Let's look locally. U.S. Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Do you know offhand if he is for or against adding to the debt or deficit long term as the Senate considers this issue?
Yeah, I spoke to Senator Toomey just last week. And he's not optimistic about spending cuts to pay for a tax overhaul. He is not optimistic about revenue raisers, in a way that can raise enough money to pay for what he thinks is a significant enough tax to make a difference. He's proposing a very different way. He's proposing to change the rules so that they don't have to worry about adding to the deficit after the 10-year window. He's essentially saying, let's make that 10-year window 20 years or maybe 30 years. That way we can pass a tax cut that adds to the deficit and not have to worry about it for another 20 or 30 years. And by then, who knows, it would be probably harder to, you know, to have that tax cut expire than it would be in, say, 10 years. So I think that's the way he's going. It's preliminary. It's early. I kind of tried to gauge support for that. And most senators don't really want to go there yet.
Yeah. Characterizing it as kicking the can down the road, or am I wrong about that?
Well, it's a change to the rules, right? The Senate is a pretty archaic institution. It does not like to change the rules. They're there for a reason. And you need a majority of senators to change the rules. In other words, Republicans would need 50 out of 52 with the vice president breaking the tie in that scenario. It's not easy to get 50 senators to change the rules. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. All right. Let's get back to President Trump, Sahil Kapoor. He was quoted recently as saying, our tax bill is moving along in Congress, and I believe it's doing very well. You know, there is no tax bill as such as of yet. There was an outline released a couple months ago by the administration. In short, what does it propose?
Well, it's a one-pager. It's a pretty vague one-pager. It includes a dozen bullet points. It proposes to collapse the individual income tax code to three brackets with, I believe, a top rate of 35%. It includes a large corporate tax cut with bringing the rate down to 15%. And then it calls for protecting certain exemptions and deductions like the mortgage interest deduction and charitable contributions, two of the most popular ones in the code. And then beyond that, it doesn't really go into how it would raise revenue to pay for this sort of thing. So I think it's essentially, you know, also the other thing I should note, it doubles the standard deduction, which would be the most significant benefit for middle-class Americans in that proposal. But it doesn't specify how it would raise the money to pay for it. And without that, it would be, I guess, depending on how some of these specifics shake out, a multi-trillion dollar addition to the debt in the long term, which, again, difficult pill to swallow.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, we might have more from the president. When? I'm hearing over the summer?
Well, we don't know that yet. I think where they are now is that you have six individuals meeting on a pretty regular basis. The president's economic advisor, Gary Cohn, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, two of them are sort of driving the train for the administration on this issue, meeting on a regular basis with the top Republican in the House, top Republican in the Senate, and the chairman of the tax writing committees in the House and the Senate. All Republicans, all men, they're meeting regularly. They want to get on the same page before moving any proposal. In other words, before introducing any legislation. That is what Republicans are saying now. They want to get an agreement on at least a concept between the House, the Senate, and the White House before advancing a bill. The theory there is politically, you don't want to fall on your sword for a proposal that won't get far, that won't end up becoming law because the other chamber would kill it. That's one of the reasons they say they learned from healthcare.
And Sahil, how would you characterize these conversations that are going on between the Hill and the White House? Contentious, collegiate, what would you say?
Collegiate, yes. I don't know about intensive. I think I keep hearing that they're essentially preliminary discussions, that they're in the early phases, that they're just talking about things on a broad level. I still think it's about 10,000 foot right now. They're not delving into specific details of how to agree on particular concepts and how much it would raise. They have staffers who are working on menus of options essentially for them, and it's mostly discussions of how I would characterize it.
Right. So Republicans want to see tax reform legislation in place when? This year?
Well, the initial goal was first 200 days. That seems increasingly unlikely with Congress bogged down with a health care proposal, which is currently in the Senate. Now the goal is by the end of 2017, yes.
And why the rush?
Well, the moment you get into 2018, it's an election year, and everything gets more complicated in an election year because politicians tend to be risk-averse. You have not only the general election in November, but you have primaries in the spring where members would be watching their back for challengers. Republicans are, and in the House in particular, tend to be more worried about a primary challenger from the right because a lot of them are in gerrymandered districts where the makeup of the district is such that they're almost, it's almost impossible to lose to a Democrat, but it's very plausible to lose to a right-wing challenger. And voting for a tough proposal, like a tax reform proposal, which would, by definition, if it's revenue neutral, raise a lot of money by targeting certain parts of the public and certain business groups, and that could be politically painful, even for Republicans facing some potential primary challengers. So you don't want to get into election year and do something big. That's always perilous, which is why Republican leaders are insistent that they get it done this year.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about what Congress has before it, before the summer break. I mean, that's coming up. And, you know, how much time realistically do members of Congress have to hammer this out? And then what do they have facing them after they come back from the recess?
Yeah, it's a pretty rough calendar right now. So at this point, the Senate is working on health care. They're expected to work on health care until at least the July 4th break. We're picking up some indications that they're not going to vote until the independents, they're not going to vote on a health care bill before the Independence Day recess. That could change, but that's where they are right now. So after they come back, they'll only have about 3 weeks to pass a bill before the August recess. Once they come back from that, that's when things get very busy. They have to fund the government by September 30th. That proved to be a pretty difficult task, even though Republicans control the White House and both chambers of Congress. Usually is not under a united government. It has been for this group. They have to extend expiring programs like the Children's Health Care Program and flood insurance. Again, difficult decisions here about how much the government should spend, what it should spend money on. Some people are going to want to reform these programs. It's not going to be easy. Then the debt limit. This is the vote that the Republicans hate most. The United States is going to be brushing up against the limits of the borrowing authority, and Congress has to raise it to prevent the United States from defaulting. That's another difficult vote that the Republicans are going to have to take sometime this fall.
I'm going to have to stop you, Sahil. Unfortunately, we could go on with this. Sahil Kapoor of Bloomberg News, thanks so much for joining us. Up next, the Dodd-Frank Act. Keep it here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. The Dodd-Frank Act was enacted a few years after the financial crisis of 2008 in an effort to help prevent another great recession. Dodd-Frank increased protections for consumers and overhauled and tightened regulations for the banking industry and was adopted largely without the support of Republicans, many of whom say the legislation is stifling economic growth and proving a burden to consumers. So last week, the House passed what's called the Financial Choice Act, which would roll back many of the Dodd-Frank regulations. And last night, the Treasury Department issued its proposals. Renee Merle is here now to give us a sense of what this might mean to consumers and the banking industry. And Renee reports on Wall Street for The Washington Post. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. So first, let me give the comment line number out. It is 267-405-2006. If you'd like to jump in with calls or comments, you can text them to us as well. Renee, before we get into the Financial Choice Act, the FCA, take us back, if you will, to 2010, the year Dodd-Frank was enacted. If you could just describe the economic climate as we were emerging from the Great Recession and what Dodd-Frank attempts to do to prevent such a collapse from happening again.
So if you remember back in 2010, we were still in the midst of the housing crisis. Thousands upon thousands of people were in foreclosure, losing their homes. The unemployment rate was still fairly high. And people were losing their jobs. And so the Obama administration started to work on the Dodd-Frank as a way to prevent all of those things from happening again.
So the Republican answer to Dodd-Frank is the Financial Choice Act. If you could give us a quick overview of some of the major points, so what it would do to roll back the regulations of Dodd-Frank.
So the Financial Choice Act, led by Republicans, does a couple of things. One of the major things is that it says if a bank has more capital, if it has more of an emergency financial cushion, it can just opt out of many of the regulations already in place. Most banks aren't expected to do that. So instead, what it does is ease a lot of banking regulations so that banks right now have to go through a stress test every year. A stress test is just a really complicated process, but it requires the bank to prove that they could withstand a financial calamity of some sort. So instead of having to go through that every year, they would go through that every other year. So it eases the regulations in some ways like that. But one of the more significant things it does that really directly impacts consumers or real people is it rolls back the power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. Dodd-Frank created this agency, and it polices banks and how they interact with consumers, with payday loans, with mortgages, checking accounts, all of those things. The CFPB is involved in those things, and the Republican bill would roll back its powers, say it doesn't have the power to enforce or create new rules. Right now, the CFPB has a database of consumer complaints. It rules back a lot of those provisions.
So, as a matter of fact, Renee, under the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, well, the CFPB was the bureau that was responsible for the fine of $100 million given to Wells Fargo last year for opening up, a couple million accounts customers didn't ask for?
Exactly. So CFPB was one of the lead agencies in that case. Wells Fargo, you remember, had to fire 5,000 employees because these employees had opened up accounts that people didn't request and want. And sometimes it cost those consumers money. It dinged their credit ratings. And CFPB gave it the agency's largest fine, $100 million. So with the rollback proposed by Republicans, CFPB would no longer have the power to do that.
So wondering if there were no CFPB, if this would have been the case with Wells Fargo. Okay. And again, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the Treasury Department last night issued its ideas regarding rollback to regulations under Dodd-Frank. How would the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau fare under the Treasury Department's proposal?
So the Treasury Department doesn't go as far as the Republicans in the House did, but it also says that perhaps the CFPB needs to be reined in. That's a major complaint of Republicans. They feel like the CFPB has too much independence. Their budget is not set by Congress like some agencies. The head of the agency can only be fired for cause. Whereas, the Republicans feel like that the head of the agency should be able to fire the head of the agency for whatever reason. You'll need a reason to fire the head of the agency, but right now you have to fire that person for cause. So they feel like that those things should be rolled back. Now, the Treasury report says they recognize some of the same complaints, but don't go as far in trying to strip the CFPB of power.
And any indication at this early juncture, Renee, as to how the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau might fare in the Senate with this provision?
Well, the Senate is a trickier place for the Republicans, one, because they would need Democrats to come on board, and they have one big obstacle, Senator Elizabeth Warren. The CFPB was the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren, and for many people, any effort to tinker with its independence is a non-starter for her and for a lot of other Democrats. So it's a matter of can Republicans put together a bill that will win some Democratic support on other measures that will still allow it to make changes with the CFPB. That seems like a high hill to get over at this point.
All right, I'm not hearing Renee. Wondering if we still have the connection. We might need to reconnect with Renee Merle. She is a reporter for The Washington Post covering Wall Street, and we are talking about the Dodd-Frank Act and also the Financial Choice Act, which was passed by the House last week. It would roll back many of the Dodd-Frank regulations. In particular, one of the regulations concerns the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, authorized by Dodd-Frank, spearheaded by Senator Elizabeth Warren. And I hear now that we have Renee back. Sorry about that, Renee. You back with us?
I sure am. Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. Okay. So, as you alluded to earlier, many Republicans in Congress have been unhappy with Dodd-Frank since its inception. They claim it chokes economic growth, in particular affects small community banks, making it harder for them to make loans. Do they have a point in here somewhere?
You know what? I would say so. When I talk to community banks, regional banks, banks that, you know, have, let's say, $200 million in assets compared to somebody like J.P. Morgan, which has more than $2 trillion in assets, you know, a bank that really just serves its local community, they're now having to comply with more rules and rules that really were aimed at more sophisticated banks like J.P. Morgan. And so they have to, like, hire somebody to do compliance. And while that, you know, J.P. Morgan's hired thousands of people to deal with compliance, but for a small community bank, having to hire another person to deal with compliance is actually really costly. It's something that's a bigger burden on them. So there is, I think, almost bipartisan support for providing community banks some relief. The bigger issue, though, is that the community banks are still doing quite well despite these regulations. They've reached near record profits last year. The industry overall, banking industry overall, reached record profits. Loan volumes are up. So the argument's a little tricky that, yes, the community banks are feeling the pressure of these regulations, but it hasn't stopped them from increasing their profits.
Ah. Well, Renee Merle, describe the Volcker Rule, which would also be repealed under the House version of the Financial Choice Act. And what would be the fallout if the Volcker Rule were actually repealed?
So the Volcker Rule basically says that a bank can no longer make bets, risky bets, with its own money. So what the rule attempts to do is say that we don't want banks that are insured by the FDIC, you know, backed by, you know, taxpayers, basically, to be making risky bets that could put them in financial trouble that taxpayers would then have to bail them out from. This rule was put in place as part of Dodd-Frank in 2013. So banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have had to get rid of what they call the proprietary trading desk.
And it's been hard for them to do so, hasn't it? I mean, Goldman Sachs has been given a couple of extensions on this.
Exactly, because it also covers their investments in private equity and hedge funds, any type of what could be considered risky investments. So, for example, right now, Goldman Sachs still has about $6 billion invested in private equity and hedge funds, but it's trying to get rid of it. Just got a five-year extension. You know, and the other part of this is that banks, especially Goldman Sachs, used to make a lot of money from the proprietary trading. For Goldman Sachs, it used to be about 10% of its revenue. So having to Volcker Rule was one of the more contentious parts of Dodd-Frank because it really spoke directly to how banks make a lot of their money. So the Choice Act would get rid of the rule altogether, say. This rule no longer exists, so banks could go back to where they were in the beginning, before the financial crisis.
And this is as it stands. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Renee.
No. And I was going to say, the Treasury report that was released late last night takes a more nuanced view, says there are problems with the Volcker Rule, would exempt more banks from having to comply with it, but wouldn't get rid of it altogether. Ah. But the House Republicans want to get rid of it altogether.
Okay, so that's in the House. And again, do we have any sense of what the Senate, how the Senate would deal with the Volcker Rule?
So the Senate hasn't spoken much on this issue. So I know that the Senator Corker, who's kind of leading this effort there, agrees that there are problems with the Volcker Rule. Again, this is the kind of thing that would be a potential non-starter with Democrats. So I think it's much more likely we'll see some changes to the Volcker Rule if the Senate decides to address it rather than a wholesale repeal of it.
All right. We're talking to Renee Merle, who covers Wall Street for The Washington Post. And Renee, as you write, the Financial Choice Act, at least as it has been passed by the House, would also eliminate rules meant to rein in Wall Street pay. Why were those rules enacted in the first place?
So you're revisiting the financial crisis again. At that point, a lot of banks were making obviously record profits, but also issuing very big bonuses to their employees. And even after they got bailed out by taxpayers, they were issuing pretty exorbitant bonuses to employees. And so the Obama administration insisted on some restrictions on that, basically saying that a trader shouldn't be able to get a hefty bonus for something, for a bet that could go wrong later. For example, you know, during the crisis, that traders were making a lot of money from these packaging these mortgages, but then those mortgages went bad later, but they got to keep the bonus money. So this is an attempt by the Obama administration to say, Wall Street, you need to take a second look at how you pay your people, and make sure that they're not being incentivized to take risky bets, because they're not going to have to pay the consequences. They're going to get their bonus, and then, you know, taxpayers have to bail it out later when the bets go bad.
So, there's a lot of pushback to this legislation on the Hill among special interest groups. Nick, can you kind of give us some indication of who's doing the pushing and what they're saying?
So, in opposition, there's actually some, it's pretty interesting. The AARP, for example, objects to the bill because of what it will do to CFPB. Veterans groups also object because of what it would do to CFPB. The CFPB has been pretty aggressive in going after financial firms that fraudulently go after seniors or veterans. They've issued lots of fines in those areas. So those two groups, for example, are pushing it back against the legislation. Shareholder groups also object to it because it does take some measures that make it harder for shareholders to have a say on how much pay a CEO makes, for example. And also just a lot of consumer groups or advocacy groups that have been watching the banking sector since the financial crisis. They feel like it's a rollback of in time that is almost as if, Republicans have forgotten what happened to the financial crisis and they want to roll things back to the way things were. So those groups as well.
Well, then that leads to the next question. So if the Financial Choice Act were to be signed into law as it stands now, having passed the House, how would Wall Street be regulated as compared to how it was regulated before the Great Recession? I mean, is it kind of back to the future or?
Not completely. Some of the framework of Dodd-Frank would still exist, but it would be under much weaker, it would be just be a much weaker framework. One example that I think is interesting is that there's this panel called FSOC. That's led by the head of the Treasury Department, Steve Mnuchin, which has the power to say, you bank, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, you're too big to fail. If you fail, your failure could cause harm to the rest of the economy. So we're going to put more rules on you. You're going to have stricter capital requirements, those sorts of things. So the House bill would weaken FSOC's power to do all of those things, including like designating an insurance company like MetLife right now is fighting because it doesn't want to be designated too big to fail, which is something that the Obama administration was pushing. So it just allowed some big banks more freedom from rules, and that some institutions like MetLife and Prudential insurance companies wouldn't be regulated at all. It gives the industry much more leeway from regulation.
All right. Well, stay tuned. Thanks, Renee Merle, so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Renee Merle covers Wall Street for the Washington Post. And this reminder, check out our Facebook page and podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times. Thank you.